Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. Today's guest is Bio member Charlotte Jacobs. Her previous work includes two biographies, Jonas Salk, A Life, and Henry Kaplan and the Story of Hodgkin's Disease. Her latest biography, 90 Seconds to Midnight, was published on June 1st, 2025 by the University of Nebraska Press. I caught up with Charlotte Jacobs on May 30th, 2025 via Zoom and began our interview by asking about the title of her book.
90 Seconds to Midnight refers to the doomsday clock, which is a metaphorical clock that's used by atomic scientists to indicate how close humanity is to a potential catastrophe. It was started in 1946, and it's readjusted yearly depending on any of the potential global issues, climate control, nuclear weapons, infections. And as my biography ended, the story ended, we were at 90 seconds to midnight. So that's why I chose that title. Now we're at 89 seconds to midnight because it's reset every year. And that's because supposedly closer to catastrophe. In fact, somebody asked me, a prior editor said to me, well, that's a good title, but what are you gonna do if the time has changed when your book is published? And I said, well, I'm using the time that the book ended.
Talk to me about your biographical subject, Setsuko.
Setsuko Nakamura Thurlow is a Japanese-Canadian, a world-renowned anti-nuclear activist. At age 13, she was working at a Japanese Army headquarters, 1 mile from the Hypo Center, when on August 6, 1945, the U.S. dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Setsuko lost almost everything except her indomitable will. Never again, she vowed, and with that began her lifelong quest to abolish nuclear weapons. It spans 7 decades pitting her against leaders of the nuclear armed states, culminating in the UN treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons, and sharing acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize. One of my favorite statements she used to make, because she told her story over and over again when she was done, I'm not interested in your sympathy. I want your action.
Yeah, she wasn't really playing a game. When she came to Lynchburg, Virginia for a year of schooling in the segregated South, no less, people were bewildered by this Japanese woman coming to study at their university. She rustled some feathers when she arrived. She seems to be a very bold person, and she's still alive. Tell me about this spirit of hers. She didn't step away from controversy.
I thought a lot about, and I spent a lot of time with her, and I spent a lot of time thinking about her intense commitment and how it's persisted for a lifetime, and where did it come from? And I think part of it is, as a descendant of a samurai whose code of conduct emphasized honor, discipline, and fearlessness in the face of the enemy. That was one. Her mother was a Buddhist, and her mother continually reminded her that it was her duty to help take care of those less fortunate. Then when she was in high school, she met Reverend Tanimoto, who was actually one of the main characters in Hershey's book, Hiroshima. And he introduced her to Christianity and the teachings, and she was baptized finally in her teen years. And then some of it was the inspiration from other dedicated people who also spent their lives trying to abolish nuclear weapons. And then the thing that still keeps her going and will continue to keep her going is the frustration, first with academics who keep saying, yes, it was the right thing to do to bomb Hiroshima and justify it, and her indignation at world leaders who just persist in building up their nuclear arsenals to threaten others. And so all of those things, I think, continue, all of those forces allow her to continue to have this amazing commitment, which was also fostered by her wonderful husband, Jim.
Yeah, he plays such a big role in her accomplishments. She proves that one person can change the world indeed. One of the things that really drew me into this book was this very first scene where she has just come out of the rubble and soldiers are telling her to go to the mountain. And along the way, I can almost smell the burning flesh. I can see the blood running in the river. I can see people without teeth because, you know, their teeth were blown out from this bomb. People vomiting blood. This prologue of your book is so visceral. And I wonder what that was like for you to not only hear it maybe firsthand, but also to document it in such a way that makes me feel so compelled to keep reading. Can you tell me about writing that chapter or that prologue and also why you chose to start the book in that way?
Yes, I rewrote the I rewrote the prologue many times. I was adamant with my wonderful agent that I was not going to use the prologue to talk about myself and why I was interested in this story, that I was not going to be in this book, and that this was about her, and that I really did want to start right in the middle of a scene. I had studied biography writing for many years, and I just had to go back and think a moment about how most of the classic biographies start. And so I picked out the Life of Johnson by Boswell, and just to have a comparison. Now, of course, Johnson was well known. And so with someone you know, and it is well known, it's okay to just start at the beginning. And he starts, Samuel Johnson was born at Litchfield in Staffordshire on the 18th of September, 1709. And his initiation into the Christian church was not delayed, for his baptism is recorded in the register of St. Mary's parish in that city to have been performed on the day of his birth. And so that's how that book starts. And I don't say that in a negative sense, because of course this is the first classic biography, but I couldn't start with her birth because the reader's going to go, well, why do I care? You know, and I could start by saying, oh, you know, I wrote starting at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. No, that didn't work. Or many, many different ways. And so when I got to it, I thought, this scene just touched me. And I not only heard it once, she uses it over and over in her speeches. And so I've heard it so many times, but to hear it face to face with her is just heart-wrenching. And so that's why I did decide to start with. When she reached the base of the mountain, she found an army training ground the size of two football fields packed with thousands of dead and dying. The air reeked of burnt flesh. And then the things you talked about. And it ends with her trying to bring water to all of those people all night long, practically. And then it ends with, so when the sun rose on August 7th, 1945, she stood up, surveyed the unimaginable carnage on the ground below, and pressed on. Here's this 13-year-old, and she's going to a stream, putting her blouse, strips of water, and taking it back to these people who were just melted flesh. And how could she do it? And so to me, as a reader not knowing her, I'd say, whoa, I've got to know about this person. And in fact, that was one of the things that drove me to being very interested in writing her biography. And that is, how could this 13-year-old girl who crawled out of a collapsed building to see 27 classmates being burned alive, and then she's evacuated to this field where she looks and there are 1,000 people and they're all bleeding and disfigured and begging, pleading for water. And she doesn't go sit on the edge of the field and cover her hands or eyes and cry for her mother. She gets up and starts looking for a stream and continues all day long with two other classmates who did survive, who she directed to tear off parts of their blouses, and they continue to bring water. So I wanted to know, how in the world did she not yield to despair? Thinking back, of course, is something that's clergy and philosophers have dealt with for centuries, right? And how can one have a meaningful life amid death and destruction? She somehow took this trauma and processed it and emerged with this incredibly positive life force. How could you not want to write about that person and learn more about her?
Well, it's interesting to me because your first two biographies are of dead men, and this is your first biography of somebody who's alive. I wanted to find out, first of all, what constitutes a Charlotte Jacobs biography, and then what led you to write this one?
I'm a physician and a professor at Stanford University, now retired, but during my first sabbatical year, I decided to study creative writing because you can do anything you want during your sabbatical year. And so I began learning the craft of just writing. That year, Henry Kaplan, who was probably one of the giants in cancer therapy, who designed the first linear accelerator to treat cancer and who was this incredible presence, developed lung cancer and died quickly. I just woke up one morning and said, somebody has to write his biography. I'm going to write his biography. And it was just a very fascinating journey, a very lonely journey, because I didn't know any biographers. They didn't seem to be any on Stanford campus. And I did study the craft with an award-winning creative writing instructor there. That was terrific experience for me. And then, despite the fact that my boss told me that writing a biography was not something I should be doing, and I was coming up for promotion, and that was based on my scientific work. And then when I finished it, I enjoyed it so much, I did want to do another biography. And again, who came right out? Jonas Salk. Jonas Salk was the hero of my generation, right? He was absolutely adored by the American public. He was a hero, and yet he was scorned by the scientific community. Why, I wondered. Now, I was actually a polio pioneer. So, I mean, Jonas Salk, I was in his trial in a little town in Tennessee. So that was another very different kind of journey. And when I was done with that, I still knew I probably had another biography in me. But instead of a who, this time it was a what. What did I want to write about? And at that time, when the Jonas Salk biography finished, 9 countries held almost 16,000 nuclear weapons. And of course, there were always the concerns that an accident might happen or something. Faulkner, William Faulkner, had said at his Pulitzer Prize ceremony, when he gave his talk, he said he was not going to work on the problems of the human spirit anymore because the only question in his mind is, when will I be blown up? Now, I had 5 grandchildren at that time, and I wanted to do something, and I wondered what role I could play as a biographer. So I decided I wanted to write a story about someone who had survived an atomic bombing called a hibakusha in the Japanese, and attempt to educate myself and the general public. Then came the who. I didn't know any hibakusha. I started looking in the U.S. because that would be much more convenient than going to Japan. But a lot of hibakusha had died. Most of those living did not want to talk about it. They had blotted it from their minds. And I had a hard time finding anyone until one day I was kind of surfing on the web and I heard this talk by someone named Setsuko Thurlow. And it was mesmerizing. Oh my God, she told that story. And I knew it had to be her. I knew it had to be her, but I couldn't find her. It was hard to find any contact for her in Canada. And finally, I found an old contact number from a social service agency she ran, and I sent her a note. And 3 days later, I was in the clinic seeing my patients, and the nurse knocked on the door, and she said, "You have a long-distance call from Canada." I said, "I'll take it." It was Setsuko. And she said, "This is amazing." She said, "I've been hoping to find someone who would tell my and my family's story." 2 months later, I was on a plane to Toronto, and that's when it started. It was because of a topic, not necessarily the person initially, but she was the person once I found her.
Well, her story really comes to light in this biography. It's a haunting book. You have an insert of photos in the center of the book. I wanted to know, I'm sure there were a lot of images that you maybe could have chosen, and I wanted to know why you chose the ones you did and what that process was like.
I like photos, and I like photos always in the middle. I don't like them scattered throughout the book. And I like them to kind of tell a story. And usually when I open a new biography, I don't want to look at the pictures and the photos yet. I want to create it in my mind, but invariably I'm about 5 pages in and I'm looking at the photos. So I've always thought the photos are important. Obviously, most of the photos of her early years were destroyed. I mean, and most everything was destroyed in Hiroshima. So there wasn't a huge batch of pictures that people could choose from. There are some on the internet, and I was able to get permission through. We go to media, I guess. I was able to get permission for some of those. And then Setsuko did have lots of photographs, but not of that. But she did have some from the earlier years. And she kept them all in just boxes, totally random. Setsuko is very colorful. Setsuko always wears bright red or bright green. And even at 92, she makes sure her hair is fixed correctly. And then she has on a nice shade of lipstick. So it wasn't hard to get permission. I just needed her permission and ICANN's permission for some and a couple of other organizations she worked with, but those were not difficult. My very favorite picture is her at the Nobel Peace Prize, relaxing in this beautiful kimono that was her mother's, just very peaceful before the ceremony. And unfortunately, it's in black and white, and it just doesn't give you the full oomph.
Of course, you went to Japan, right? When you were preparing for this project, what were some of the things that you knew that you had to learn? For instance, Japanese culture. I'm assuming that you had to go to Hiroshima and visit some museums and that sort of thing. What were some of the archives that you visited and some of the trips that you made in writing this book or in doing your research for this book?
Well, Hiroshima obviously was the place I wanted to go. I arranged that trip, and a friend, a lawyer friend who helped me a lot with the book, went with me. Interestingly, it just so happened to be at a time that Setsuko was there. So that was nice. She was very busy with a conference, but she did arrange a banquet where I met all of her family. And that was really to see these people that I'd heard about, the ones that were living. Was really quite wonderful. And so that was good. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to walk the escape route that she did when she left the burning building and stand on that hill where she stood and kind of visualize that. The rivers, particularly the River Oda, but there are major rivers in Hiroshima, I stood on the banks and imagined them filled with dead and dying people because the rivers were just all clogged. People would run and try to get into the river or be pushed into the river because they were burning, and most of them didn't swim at that period in time. And I kind of wanted to imagine that. I wanted to see what was left of the school, the school that was rebuilt. And then I spent an enormous amount of time in the Peace Park, and that's where the museum is. And that's where the memorial is. And you can't go to that museum and not be come out absolutely horrified about what a nuclear weapon could do and having so much regard for the people. And it really it's just wonderfully done. It's wonderfully done. So I was walking out the back of the museum and walking down the street, and I think it was still in part of the edge of the park. And I saw this statue and I went, oh my gosh, that's going to be the cover of the book. I mean, I wasn't even partway through writing the book. That has to be the cover. So the second person that went with us happened to be a photographer, an artist. And I dragged her out there and I said, take that picture. Now, unfortunately, this isn't her version because it somehow didn't work. And the press tracked down the person who actually did that photo. But that picture of a school teacher holding a dead student and herself just charred just says it all. And so I was so happy when Potomac Books said, yeah, because the author doesn't have control of the picture on the front. And I love that.
Yeah, it's a haunting image. My final question, is about bio. You mentioned that, bio has been really important in the writing of this biography. And I wanted to know a little bit more about your involvement with a writing group. Do you guys meet every month? Can you tell me about that?
So, well, let me go back a minute, if you don't mind. And that is, I felt like a lone ranger when I first started writing my biography. I could find no one on the Stanford campus who wrote biography. I think finally there was one who had written a prior biography. So I didn't know a biographer when I was writing. I was working with somebody who was teaching me craft, but not biography. One of the ways I was learning craft was reading biographies by some of the greats who we all know. And then I went to several writing residencies, to McDowell Colony, to Gerasi, to Ragdale. And interestingly, I never met a biographer there either. They were mostly poets and creative writers. But when I was at McDowell Colony, somebody said to me, "You know, there is a biographer here, but he really doesn't want to interact with people. He's really so intent on just his writing." And I saw him eating by himself once, and I just kind of tried to strike up a conversation. And he said to me, "You know, there's a new thing that I just heard about called Biographers International, and I read something called Biographers Craft. You need to subscribe to that, and then you'll learn about biography writing." So I did, and I went to the first Biographers International meeting. Oh my gosh. I mean, I died and went to heaven. You know, I mean, here were all these people talking about biography writing and the same things that were concerning me, and how do you publish, and craft issues, and I thought it was fabulous. And I tell everybody that I ever meet that writes biography, you have to join Biographers International. You just can't imagine what it was like before Biographers International. But when I praise it so many times, it's almost like when I say to my kids, "You don't know what it was like before internet." That's what it feels like. I think it's incredible. So one of the things that I didn't do right away, and because I didn't really know much about it, was forming a group. Now we have an international group of science writers. So this started with people who wrote science and the issues of scientists or physicians or whatnot, and the issues that they faced. And the lead is from Australia. We have people from all over the US, from Canada, and we meet month to month and discuss issues. There's nothing like having a support group. I never realized that. But beside that, you know, when I was a teenager, I couldn't wait for my 17 magazine to arrive in the mail. I'd kind of wait for it to arrive. Now I await for Biographers Craft or the Biographers International emails to arrive in the mail, in the email. So it's terrific. It's just terrific.
That was bio member Charlotte Jacobs talking with me about her book, 90 Seconds to Midnight, published by University of Nebraska Press on June 1st, 2025. We recorded this interview via Zoom on May 30th, 2025. I'm bio member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Our executive producer is Sonia Williams. Darren Nesblitt created our theme music. Thank you so much for listening.